on a Thursday, and we have three Senate bills here in front of us. We're going to take it right. Let's see. 663. Do we have the people here on 663? Everybody's here? Okay, let's start out with the opening hearing on 663. This is a bill that abolishes one tag for lifetime restriction on mountain sheep. You can come on up. The people that are involved in this bill, and Harrison will tell us what he knows about Senate Bill 663A.
Mr. Chair, members, tags for mountain sheep and mountain goats are issued in two or arguably three ways. There are regular tags, which are issued for $90 to residents, $975 to non-residents, and it's my understanding that there were approximately 60 mountain sheep tags issued in 98 and three mountain goat tags. There were roughly 10,000 applicants for the 60 and 3,500 for the three. In addition to those regular tags, there's something referred to as special tags, one of which is auctioned to the highest bidder, one is sold by raffle.
Mm-hmm.
What this bill would do is create exceptions to the existing one tag for lifetime restriction for each of those. It would allow a hunter who has received a tag but who does not take an animal under that tag to come back and apply 7 years later. It would also allow...
That's just apply. There's no guarantee.
No guarantee that they're going to get it.
Yep.
It would allow them to apply just
right
after 7 years. Also, it would lift the limitation on the raffle and auction. That is, if you're willing to come back and participate in the raffle or the auction, you can come back the next year, whether you've taken an animal or not.
So if you have the money, you can buy in, so to speak.
So that one available tag, or if you're lucky in the raffle.
Okay, I guess with that issue, we need to be persuaded why we need to do this. So with that, we welcome you here this morning. Whoever would like to lead off?
Chair Wells, for the record, my name is Rich Berry, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm Wildlife Division Director. First, I might add that this is not a bill that the department was introduced by others, however, is one which we would support. The amendments that the engrossment bill, I believe Mr. Connolly has accurately portrayed what would go on there. Two things that may happen. In Section 6A, which is your first section, it would allow a successful hunter to reapply, or excuse me, one who drew a tag but was not successful, after a 7-year wait period, they could reapply. We feel this would be negligible, as Mr. Connolly talked about, the number of tags that are available and the number of people that apply. Really, the chances of you getting this once in a lifetime tag, as it currently is very slim. It's a trophy type tag, and once you get one, you have accomplished a major feat. The chances of being successful again are probably going to be very minimal for someone to apply, but it just does give an opportunity if they were unsuccessful for whatever reason. And with the bighorn sheep, our success rate is somewhere between 90 to 95%, depending on the year. So generally, they are very successful, but it would just give the opportunity for someone to reapply again. The second portion under 6B applies to the auction raffle portion. That is set up in statute where we can offer a raffle tag or an auction tag. Under the auction program, one thing that we see is that the revenue generated tend to be kind of a select group of individuals who have the dollars to actually apply for these things. And they're not necessarily applying just for the hunt, but they are, in fact, spending the dollars to support the programs. And we have seen some decline in that. This last year, in 1999, the auction tag went for $87,500. The high that Oregon has ever achieved was in 1994, was $110,000, and this money goes into our management programs. So we would see this as just the potential to keep those dollars up there, and some of the individuals who like to bid on these, not necessarily being once they've done it one time, that they cannot do it again. We believe it may add, just keep the revenue at a higher level. That's it. I can answer any questions.
Representative Hill, I see you have your hand up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this isn't the, you know, people out in Lane, they like to taste the goat meat.
Representative Hill, that's correct. These are trophy animals that they're going for.
Well, I personally like goat meat. Let's move into work session.
Who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We're in support of Senate Bill 663, A engrossed. Section 6A, before we supported that, we talked to Mr. Berry and Mr. Rollator and Mr. Greer about the impact that would have. They told us it was minimal, and we think it would be a good opportunity for a person who doesn't fill their tag to be able to go back after a seven-year period. Section 6B is an amendment that we introduced on the Senate side, Mr. Chair, and we support that section of the bill as well. We feel the money is needed for research and development. Mr. Berry has given you the financial figures, and we think it's a good practice, and would hope to it would continue on raising that amount of money. We'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, welcome, Chuck. Are you going to agree or disagree with these guys?
Agree both.
It looked like you had a little disagreement here in the handout here.
Right. Well, good morning, Chairman Wells, and ladies and gentlemen of the excuse me, committee. I'm Chuck Woosley of Corvallis, Oregon, and you have my written testimony before you, and I won't go through it and read it to you. You're undoubtedly better readers than I am. But I do disagree with paragraph 6A of the bill as it is currently written. Yes, it would have a very small impact on the number of hunters if it were introduced. But in 1998, there was 1,116 applications for each of those three goat tags. And I've just been informed there were 68 resident tags instead of 58. So that would reduce my figure there of the average of 175 applications for each mountain sheep tag. Thus, the possibility of drawing one is actually less than once in a lifetime. I feel the current law gives a fair and equitable distribution of these tags to all interested hunters, and to let even, say, 5 to 6, 7, 8 hunters a year back into that pool after 7 years, then it diminishes the other opportunities for that hunt. And the hunt isn't just going out into the animal's domain. Any true hunter does a lot of anticipation, preparation, learning the animal's habits and such beforehand. And mountain sheep and mountain goat are considered to be the premier big game animals in the state of Oregon. And I think it's great that we have that program rebuilding back. I fully support it in a number of ways, including sweat and blood on volunteer projects. But I would like to see you and request that you not accept paragraph 6A so as to continue to give the maximum number of hunters that opportunity. But please approve paragraph 6B to maintain the maximum pool, though, of those auction tag hunters or buyers. They are a unique group. I know several of them, and I think it's great that they're willing to put their financial resources where their heart is. And thank you. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Chuck, did you testify in the Senate on this bill?
No, I was not aware of this bill until after it was approved in the Senate.
Well, I understand the issue. You're gutting the heart out of this bill because it was brought on behalf of a particular individual who, because of illness or something, fell into this category under 6A. They wanted to have an opportunity to come back and try again. So you kind of got the heart out of the bill if you took out 6A. In the B section was added, I think, on behalf of the Wildlife Commission. And so
I you might have run into resistance over there from the sponsors of the bill by taking out that section. Am I true on
yes.
this?
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. I believe I heard that in either in testimony or someone talked about that in relation to the person that wanted to give it one more chance at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember who that was.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find myself in an awkward position here as a avid hunter and a member of the Oregon Hunter Association, but I can't support this concept. There are many people out there, myself included, who have tried over and over and over again to draw special tags, bighorn sheep. I personally have never drawn an antelope tag in the state, which many people find hard to believe, but I've applied every year I possibly can. I've never been able to be successful in that. And to open this pool up to people who have had that opportunity once, I agree entirely with Chuck. I think it's great to leave 6B in, but because those are a special type of a person who, you know, that's not the average person, but to open the pool and makes it that much harder for people such as myself who have never been able to draw these tags, I just, it's not a concept I want to support. And if I get a chance to go on a sheep hunt someday and I'm not successful, at least I'll have had the experience to make the hunt.
You have someone to help you out on your issues.
Thank you, Representative Byer. I appreciate that. I too have been unsuccessful each year.
Representative Hill, weigh in here on this.
I have never applied for a big sheep farm license, and I can't imagine that I ever would, and I'll defer to my colleagues. It's six of one, half of a dozen of the other on this one.
Representative Herbalaw, you're thinking. Which way we're going to go on this?
Well, I don't.
This is the last. This is your shot. The people are testifying here in front of us, so we'll have to.
Well, that's the question.
What we want to do.
The question I was going to throw out, I don't know much about hunting, but if you draw these tags, there's three of them. Can't you have when they draw them, draw five, but two are in reserve in case something happens to the person, like they become sick or have to go out, and so then they would be counted as not having a tag. And all three of them would still be used.
Chair Wells, Representative Rubelau, the potential is that you could potentially do that. I guess I would look at what you may happen as the individual has no idea who is in reserve. And then again, would that count that they had been successful? Again, there may be a circumstance that an individual can't go, but as Representative Byer said, these are very unique, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and people do essentially everything once you are successful to do that tag. I think it just might complicate the system, and we might start seeing excuses of why I couldn't go, and they would be taking a chance that they may never again draw a tag again.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Krupp, what do you think? I don't know where my votes are on this.
I
the committee here.
I'm not in favor of this bill.
Pardon?
I'm not in favor of this bill.
Okay.
As a whole, I agree with Representative Byer. I guess if a person has been trying for years and years and years to obtain a tag, and there's such a limited number. If you have the opportunity and you go out and enjoy the outdoors and you go out and you go hard after your hunt, and given the facts that I believe I was reading the department's testimony here, that the success rate for sheep and goat hunters is very high, 70 to 100%, which is astounding to me as a hunter. I've never hunted those, although my grandfather did. And I will tell you that if you, because there's such a limited number, if you're able to obtain a tag and you are successful, I don't see why you should be able to go out and do it again if there's a lot of other people out there who never have the opportunity. And that's, I don't think I'm willing to support this bill based on that issue.
Where would we be if we took out the 6A and left the B, and then we go back to the Senate and
conference or get them to agree, I suppose. Well, Mr. Chair, if unless I'm reading 6B incorrectly, it says that if you've taken a mountain sheep before, you're eligible again.
That's just the auction and raffle part.
Oh, that's just the auction and raffle?
And that's a money-raising issue, and they didn't want to limit the big money people who are willing to pay $87,000 to $100,000 for one of these.
Good grief.
Right. So that's just auction and raffles, all that applies to. Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Fire and Krupp. I've heard it said, I think, three times in the testimony, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If we pass this, it's no longer a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be true to the language, and I just think that it is a unique experience, and everybody should at least have an opportunity to do it the first time rather than allowing those to do it the second time.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we send ask for an amendment to take out 6A. I mean, and this is simply one person who, as I stated in my testimony, has tried many times to draw a bighorn sheep tag. And, you know, because I'm 100% support the idea of keeping the pool of people who are willing to pay in excess of, and sometimes over $200,000 for a sheep tag in Oregon. And, you know, that is a very important money that is needed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Access and Habitat people to run the program for the sheep. We don't want to limit that pool. And one or two tags a year, is that right? It was probably testified to before I got here.
Represented by one tag.
One tag a year, and then the easier than raffle one also. And we don't want to limit the ability for that from the raised money. In every other circumstance, I do not support the idea where we save a tag or we make it hunting available for the wealthy. I mean, I'm opposed to that concept. I was the one no vote last session on the bill that gave tags to guides and packers so they could sell them to out-of-state wealthy clients. I mean, I'm totally opposed to that concept. But in this very limited instance with sheep, you know, we need to be able to keep that pool open for the people who are willing to pay that money for this tag.
Well, you're going to love Senate Bill 992.
I know it's here.
We'll get back into that issue again.
Chair,
Representative Hill.
I believe there's a gentleman who would like to testify.
Man. Would you like to come on up, sir? while we're still thinking which way we're going here on this. Please state your name, and nice to have you here today.
My name is Mark Melgard. I'm down here usually about workers' comp issues, but I came in because I was interested in this subject. I've hunted on many continents. I have three sheep myself. I don't have a desert sheep, but I have killed sheep in Alaska and in the Cassiar and in Wyoming. And they are some tough thing to get. And I've never drawn a tag in Oregon. I always have tried. And God knows if you ever get one, they ride herd on you so that you do have a 95% chance of getting it. And you shouldn't get another chance. I have some question about, you know, whether the raffle should go on. But I know that the department needs the money, and I can appreciate that. But you shouldn't get another chance. You know, you shouldn't have our animals as a commodity.
Thank you. Any questions, committee?
Mr. Chair, I would be willing to support the bill with A removed.
Well, let's close the hearing, go into a work session, and let's go that route. Seems like that's where the votes are. So, Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, move to suspend the rules for the purpose of a conceptual amendment to House Bill 663.
Any objections to suspending the rules? We suspended the rules. I would need a motion.
Chair, I move that we conceptually amend Senate Bill 663 to remove Section 1, subsection 6A from the bill. Strike it. Lines 23 through 27, page 2.
All right. Any discussion on the motion? Anyone oppose this motion? So adopted.
Mr. Chair?
President Hill?
Move Senate Bill 663A in gross as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Got a motion to move to the floor. Any discussion? Samantha, I'd like to call the roll, please.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He's excused.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. He's excused. Senate Bill 663 has moved to the floor with a due pass. Anyone interested in carrying this bill? Trustee Hobson, have you carried one lately?
Not for quite a while.
You want to carry, you want to carry,
delighted.
You want to carry this bill?
Got it.
You do a great job carrying bills on the floor.
I mean, buy one of those tanks.
No, you may apply.
You can go to an auction and buy one.
Yeah, Representative Hobson.
Bring your big dollars.
Bring a checkbook.
Well, that will close the hearing on Senate Bill 663. And open the hearing on Senate Bill 992. And while we're getting our paperwork, Harrison will tell us what this bill does, and whoever's involved with the testifying on it, come on up.
Mr. Chair, member, Senate Bill 992 specifies that an outfitter or guide must meet certification requirements in the calendar year prior to deer and elk season to participate in the system of allocating non-resident hunting permits. It declares an emergency so that it can be effective on passage. It's my understanding that there is a system in place for allocating non-resident deer and elk tags that gives some preference to these outfitters and guides, and my understanding that essentially there was a date certain put in the original legislation last time, which effectively limited to existing outfitters and guides, but that was not really the intention, it would appear, of any of the parties, certainly not the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife or the Oregon Guides and Packers.
As you know, Representative Beyer made reference to this issue a little bit. There are some preference tags that are that we reserve. This is a bill we dealt with last session, so that these guides and packers can have these tags, out-of-state tags, available, non-resident tags available for their clients, and they had to meet then some certification requirements to, so that we knew they were legitimate outfitters and guides, and they had, for some reason or another, there was a date put in here that from January 1st, 99, the Marine Board had established the process, and they had to all meet those requirements by not later than January 1, 2000, which was a year. So what happens is now if somebody comes along and goes into the business with that language left in there, it's a problem over this date. So with that, welcome, Phil Donovan. He talked to me about this bill and represents the guides and packers. Nice to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan, representing the Oregon Guides and Packers Association. At last session, the Oregon legislature passed this program, which set aside half of the non-resident tags for clients of Oregon's outfitters. This legislation also created a certification process through the State Marine Board, which basically made sure that we had qualified and experienced guides taking these not out-of-state residents out afield. Unfortunately, they were setting up the program, and they put a what has been termed as erroneously put in a provision that would prohibit new guides from getting into the allocation process after January 1, 2000. For example, if Rich Berry here were a guide and was certified, he's fine from here forward. But if I come in January 2, 2000, and want to take advantage of this program, I would not be able to because I could not get certified through the State Marine Board. So what we'd like to do with Senate Bill 992 is require that a new guy that comes along and interested in participating in this program be certified the year prior to the year that they want to take advantage of the tags being allowed. This program has been a success. So I would characterize it as a win-win-win. It's a win for the outfitters who have an opportunity to market these hunts to out-of-state residents. It's a win for rural communities as it helps bring these out-of-state people into the communities and their spouses and families frequently join them on these extended times. And it's a win for Oregon residents because the tags that were set aside for the guides and outfitters, those that are not utilized go back into the normal draw for Oregon residents. This was not the case prior to 1997. So with that, I would be happy to respond to any questions that the committee might have.
Let's see, we have Representative Ubelano, Representative Beyer.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is not a question, mine's just a comment. Just wanted to take note of your very colorful explanation of the present program, that if the certified guides now existing were to quit or drop dead, the program would die also.
That's true. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for, first question was for Mr. Berry. Mr. Donovan said that those tags go back into the general residence pool. Is that true?
Chair Wells, Representative Beyer, that's correct. If it might help the committee, we had a similar question in Ways and Means last week, and I put together just a little one-page thing that kind of talks about the program, which I could hand out to you. It kind of is a different issue than Senate Bill 992, which is strictly the sunset of the registration. But I believe Representative Byers did have some questions on it. It might be that I could clarify
what,
that.
Yeah, if you had some other material, Rich, it might be good because probably we need a little understanding of the background of the allocation that there are, you know, these tags that are set aside and why we set those tags aside for guides and packers. Also, there might be a question of why the State Marine Board is certifying these people rather than Fish and Wildlife. And so a little background on this might not hurt if we have the time here to understand what we're doing here.
Chair Wells, members of the committee, between Phil and I will try, although both of us were not here.
By yourself for the,
My name is Rich Berry with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Wildlife Division Director. Phil and I were, both of us were not here last year, but we'll do our best to fill in the history as we go. The handout that I gave you shows that for deer and elk and controlled hunts only, by statute, we are to make available not more than 5% of the tags for each area of a hunt. And the state is divided up into many hunt units. And so what this means is that we will go back and look at a hunt area and say how many successful people there were that drew those. So non-residents could in fact draw up to 5% of the available tags. So it is limited, but that would just be the normal hunt. You and I may apply, non-residents may apply, and up to 5% might be successful. They would only be successful if their number was in the appropriate sequence of successful tag applicants. So we could have no non-residents, we could have up to 5% just depending on where they fell out. With that, then the next legislative, also by statute, it says we are to go back and look at the last year's draw for a hunt, and up to half of the non-residents that were successful tags may be made available to the guides and outfitters drawing process. So what we do is we'll go back and we'll look at the list and say, well, in this hunt there were five non-residents, therefore three rounded off, could be available for the guides and packers to apply for the following year. What they do is they go through a whole process. We will give them that information. They must then, by December 1, provide to us an application for those hunts they would like to get. We go through essentially a drawing process for them. We notify them at the end of December what they have available. Now, just because they have them available does not mean, and I'll show you here at the end, that they end up with that number. What that then allows them to do is to go out to the trade shows and so on and start to market that, in fact, They have been successful to draw for this particular hunt, and they attempt to sell a hunt and based upon that tag. By the end of March, April 1, they then must notify us that how many tags will they in fact be purchasing, and in fact they must purchase them at that time. Now, another thing within the bill is they must pay two times the non-resident fee. So it's not just the normal non-resident fee, which for a deer is $175 and an elk $290. They pay a double fee for that privilege. Just to give you an idea there, right where I kind of say tag fee is two times the normal resident, last year, for example, in 1998, we allocated 897 deer tags could be available to the guides and packers and 994 elk tags. Through the drawing process, because it could be that a number of the same outfitters applied for the same area and therefore were not successful, they had a total of 796 tags available that they could have sold. When all was said and done, they actually only sold 189 of them. That was the number of clients that they had available for them. So it starts out with a fairly large number. Now, to get to Representative Byers' question, when he said, okay, what happens to the rest of those tags? Because it says you may have that many, they essentially just go back into the pool, and those are tags that are now available for anybody. It could be a resident or a non-resident that ends up drawing them. So they're not a guaranteed non-resident tag. It only says they could have up to that amount, and if they are successful, then they could make use of those.
Do you know, of course, either one of you were here last session, the background of why we ended up with this date in here. We really weren't looking very far ahead. I guess we thought that the only people who are going to be involved are the people currently here. Do you know any other reason?
I believe they were just trying to get this process set up. Senator Hannon, actually, on the floor and reviewing the testimony, said, you're creating a limited entry program here. And Senator Tarnow said, that is not our intent to create a limited entry program. But at that point in the session, I think they were just trying to get it done. And basically, once they implemented it, they came to the Oregon Guides and Packers, and they, being the State Marine Board, and said, this might be problematic, and we agreed, and hence introduced this legislation before you. To get at your question with regards to why the State Marine Board is doing this process, is the reason is that they regulate the outfitting industry, everybody from the rafting outfitters on the Deschutes and the Rogue to fishing guides in the Tillamook to hunting guides over in Eastern Oregon. We do our licenses through the State Marine Board. We are the only industry that they regulate, interestingly enough, but that's why they have set up this process. Right now, the certification process is that of an application. It will be after or beginning this year a test, true or false, and multiple choice.
Rather than just registering, it will be more of a licensing based on some requirements.
That's right, and we will be engaged with the State Marine Board in creating the rules that surround the actual testing that takes place.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple different questions. One would be, Mr. Barry, you said that, you know, if there were five tags available, half of that would be free. I find it interesting you would round up for the guides and packers, yet for the hunters who are applying for tags, when preference points, you round down. There seems a little inconsistency there.
Representative Byers, I may be wrong, but I just rounded in my head to the three of 2.5.
Maybe we can do 2.5.
Okay, another further question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Byers.
When this bill passed in 97, and not this bill, but 3387, at that point in time, there is no provision in the bill that these tags are only for non-residents. Once the guide buys the tag from the Park, Fish, and Wildlife, he can sell that tag to anyone he chooses. Has that been changed in rule?
Representative Byer, that's correct. We did have a problem with that. It kind of circumvented what we believed and the commission believed was the intent of what the law was to be. And by rule, we did in fact change that only a non-resident can apply for this license.
One more, Chair, more of a comment, I guess, and question. Mm-hmm. What you're saying then is a wealthy out-of-state person can come in and buy any tag they want, but a wealthy Oregonian is not allowed to?
Representative Wells, Chair Byers, if they in fact go through a guides and packers, that's correct.
Yeah, that's interesting that the
It seemed like as long as the non-resident tag is someone that's in state wants to pay the non-resident fees, he should be able to buy it.
That's why I was a no 2 years ago, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wells, I believe, though, as they went through, I guess, case history and what a resident and non-resident mean, whether for a multitude of legislative actions, that that definition does apply differently. Okay.
Well, if there isn't any other questions, I'm going to close the hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 992. Representative Hill.
I move Senate Bill 992 to the floor with a two-class recommendation.
We have a motion to move. Any discussion? Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, I was going to hope maybe I'd have this attractive relating clause to gut and stuff and maybe get rid of House Bill 3387 from last session.
I don't think you're going to be that fortunate. Any other discussion? Matthew, like, call roll, please. Yes. Which is?
Yes.
No.
Aye.
Yes.
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 He's excused. Senate Bill 992 received the constitutional number of votes. It is moved to the floor. I'll carry the bill. So that will close the hearing on 992 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 673. While we get our paperwork in order, Harrison will tell us what this does, and the people that are involved in that can come on down.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 673A exempts contract loggers who meet certain requirements from double and treble damages for certain timber removal activities and holds them secondarily liable to certain persons. Under current law, when a contract logger trespasses willfully and removes timber, cuts a tree, that person is subject to treble damages, triple. When a logger unintentionally trespasses and cuts some timber, they're subject to double damages. In the case where a contract logger is hired by a person whom he believes has a right to the timber, and has a contract which has a legal description of the area, when that person who engages the logger has marked the boundaries of the property and of the operation area, when that person has provided a deed or other sort of a contract indicating the right to that timber, which the logger must keep and compare with his contract to harvest. When a logger has done all of those steps, that person is only subject to actual damages and only secondarily liable to the person who, in fact, willfully misled them.
So you can see this issue deals with potential trespass problems, sealing of timber, cutting outside the line. This has been an issue that's been around the legislature and other sessions of what happens if you cut trees outside of the boundary line, and you're a property owner, you go up there and someone's been logging next to you, and you go up there and find out they've cut 40 or 50 feet across the line into your property and pulled the trees away, and you didn't realize it. So 3 months later, you have to walk up there on your property, and these kind of things go on out there.
Mr. Chair.
So we've had legislation kind of dealing with those sort of issues. Representative Byron?
I believe that the witness, before I get to this, I think this bill is pretty similar to one that was passed last session but didn't get through the governor's office.
I don't really remember that per se, so maybe you can talk about it. So I believe this bill is here kind of on behalf of Associated Oregon Loggers, is that, I believe, although it has
yes.
these other names on here. So with that, we have, of course, Mike Miller and then Campbell's seem to be doing some lobbying for Associated Oregon Loggers. So who would like to lead off, I think, today?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Miller, Executive Vice President of Associated Oregon Loggers. And the committee administrator has done an excellent job of explaining what's going on with this particular bill. I think one thing that I might mention, though, is that while we talk about the person who severs the tree, and that's almost always a logger, contract logger, what we don't sometimes think about is that the logger is working for a landowner or working for a timber company who has contracted or entered an agreement for the logger to cut the trees. And in too many cases, we find that the logger kind of gets caught in the middle of this. And he's working with the landowner who thinks he knows where his property boundaries are at and sometimes doesn't. Or he's working for a timber company who also thinks they know where the boundary lines are at and don't. And so the logger, by virtue of being the only party that's really named in the statute, is the person who gets hauled in to court or gets sent the bill for the trespass. And that makes it very clear who the landowner can go after, which probably has some benefits. But I think the other thing that we do find that is all too common is that there are people who, in a fraudulent manner, claim that they own the timber, and they hire a contract logger to log the trees, and they may have a contract and everything else, and come to find out they're not the owner of the property. When you consider that we have somewhere around 60,000, it depends on who you talk to, 60,000 non-industrial landowners in the state or more, it depends on who you talk to, and a lot of those owners are absentee owners. There is the opportunity there for unscrupulous people to seek out these absentee plots and appropriate the timber for their own use, and we'll hear a case about that in a minute. So unfortunately, the logger who's operating in good faith gets caught in this and ends up, even if he doesn't have to pay the treble damages or single damages, can result in spending a lot of legal costs trying to show that he was operating in good faith and wasn't party to this effort. And I know Chair Wells asked on another bill, why are we changing this law at this time? I think probably all of us that have been around Oregon, especially in the business that we're in, know that for the past 50 years or so, there have been a lot of our harvests in the state come off of the federal lands as well as industry lands. In fact, we do a survey of our membership each year, and we try to find out where are you working. Are you working on the private land or federal lands? And whereas it used to be that like three-fourths of our members, the contract loggers in the state, and we represent over 800 of them, were working on federal lands, and the rest were working basically on industrial lands with some non-industrial operations going on. With the change in the federal land management, what we have seen is that the industrial lands have stayed about the same, but the operations on the non-industrial lands have just about doubled. If you look at some 10-year averages that are attached there, you can see that we went from an average of about 340 million board feet a year harvested off the non-industrial lands between 1977 and 1988. And whereas now we're looking at 670 million board feet per acre that's harvested on an average from those lands. And also the number of operations, the number of actual logging operations went from, and there's another table on this, but back in the mid-80s we were looking at 12 to 15,000 operations a year. We now have 25,000 operations a year. So you see we've got a lot more operations. The volumes actually went down, so we're working on these small tracts. The result of that has been an increase in the number of trespasses. Associated Oregon Loggers worked with Safeco Insurance, for example, a couple of years ago, and we developed a brochure that's with your material there, trying to educate our loggers to the problems associated with operating on small tracts where the land, the property lines might not be all that well known. And in fact, part of the material that's in that brochure is now included in this proposed law. And before I close, I will mention that in 1997, the last session, there was a bill passed, it was Senate Bill 1, that proposed to do basically the same thing here. The Attorney General's office stood up at the last hearing and said they didn't have any problem with the bill, but as it turned out, apparently somebody in the AG's office did have a problem. And the bill was vetoed by the governor after it passed both the House and Senate. So in the interim, what we've done is we've worked with the State Forestry Department, we've worked with the Attorney General's office and the governor's office to draft this legislation that hopefully will allow for protection for the logger as well as for the landowner. There has been some misunderstanding that we're trying to get the logger taken completely out of the picture, and therefore the landowner would have nobody to go after. But as you will hear, the landowner still has the logger or the party who contracted with the logger to go after. In my testimony, the written testimony, there is a statement that says, unfortunately, there are some corrections that are needed, which we will discuss in a moment. Those corrections actually were made on the Senate side, so the bill is in good form right now. I'd like to introduce now Dave Montgomery, who is one of the contract loggers and also a small woodland owner, who was one of the people, an example of somebody that got caught in the middle between somebody he thought owned the timber and a mill.
Thanks, Dave. Say your name for our tape, and it's nice to have you here today.
Chairman Wells and members of the committee, I'm David Montgomery. I reside at 22179 Highway 126, Notai, Oregon. In 1989, my company, Montgomery Timber Management Incorporated, was hired to log a piece of timber near Mapleton, Oregon. Our company was recommended by a local mill that wanted to purchase the logs from this unit. The seller represented himself as a timberland owner. He showed ribbon property lines to myself and to the mill representative. We entered into a written contract, and my company harvested the timber and delivered the logs to the mill, whose representative introduced me to the alleged timber owner. This whole transaction and harvest took place in approximately 3.5 weeks. 2 years later, I found out that the timber did not belong to the party that I had contracted with. It belonged to an elderly couple in California. This alleged owner took the money and ran. The mill company filed bankruptcy. I and my company were the only viable parties that could or would pay. We settled out of court for $50,000. The attorney's bill was $25,000. 2 years later, the state of Oregon discovered that approximately one half of the removed timber came off of the state lands. The state attorney general's office lacked the resolve to pursue the real crook and again came after me and my company. They offered me a deal. Pay them $49,000 or they would sue me for double stumpage, approximately $250,000. I paid the $49,000 plus another $10,000 to the attorneys. I don't think justice was served in this case. The state did not pursue the crook, even though they knew who he was and where he was. The end.
That is the worst story I have heard today. That is terrible.
Representative Lebron and Representative
Hacker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that is a terrible story, and my question is totally irrelevant to that. But we've been sitting here on the side wondering where Notai, Oregon, is.
You don't know where Notai is.
Sorry. I'm completely.
Actually, I hate to use Eugene as a reference, but it's really 40 miles east of Florence, Oregon.
Oh, okay.
20 miles west of Eugene, Oregon.
You thought
I love it.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is a really awful story. I'm sorry that. What was the rationale that the AG's office gave you in terms of why they did not pursue the fellow that had sold you or had contracted with you?
Representative Deckert, Mr. Chair, really found no conclusion that you would call rationale other than somebody had to pay. And they told me that they give me all kinds of accolades as being a very upstanding citizen and very ethical, and I had lots of backing from the district representatives of the Department of Forestry, that somebody had to pay, and I was the only one that appeared to have quote-unquote deep pockets. I no longer really have any pockets left after this.
Mr. Chair.
President Decker.
Thank you. And Mike, last time when the AG, our in the governor's veto message, what do you know what his reasoning or the AG's reasoning for their problem with Senate Bill 1 last time?
Chairman Wells, Representative Deckert, the Senate Bill 1 was drafted, and it basically said that if an operator in good faith believes that he is, you know, operating on the timber of, harvesting the timber of the owner, the question was, how do we exhibit what good faith is? What does that mean?
Right.
And we talked about some steps that would do that, and we thought the Attorney General's office agreed with it. They testified to that effect, but apparently on review after the bill was passed, they felt that we needed more in the way of examples of good faith and steps that would be taken, and that's what's included in this bill, the steps that would have to be taken on the part of the, not only the landowner, but the operator too. So that's why they feel now that we've, well, my understanding is they feel we've gotten it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume that you would do an intensive, if this passes, and I'm assuming it will, that you will do an intensive educational thing with your loggers, because it does require very specific things to happen. And, you know, most loggers out there aren't going to know that unless the organization or somebody gets out there.
Chair Wells, Representative Ubelhauer, that's exactly right. In fact, one of the things that is required, if you want this protection, in other words, if you want to avoid the treble and double stumpage, you have to have a written contract. And we're in the process of trying to develop a sample contract that loggers might use, because so many times when a logger is, in fact, I had lunch with one on Wednesday or Tuesday who was looking at a 6-acre tract, just a small, you know, not much volume. And generally, those types of operations are just a handshake. Okay, I understand where it's at. But the problem is, and attached to my testimony is a couple examples of it, sometimes the landowners who may have lived there for 50, 60 years, they think they know where the lines are at. They think that fence out there was always the line, but it wasn't. And then we find out that somebody else, it was their timber. So you're right. It's going to take an education project, which is part of what this brochure was intended to do. And because this is a fairly common problem.
Sure is. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 8, section 1, subsection 4C, so small d, it says the contract logger verifies the deed. How, is there an example of how you think the courts would interpret that in terms of given, you know, the contract logger's now in court, standing there, being sued, and what kind of burden does that place on a contract logger who, you know, isn't a title company? I mean, he looks at it and, you know, looks real to me, but, what kind of burden are we now placing on the contract logger by saying that the contract logger verifies the deed?
That's a good question, and when I read that, I thought, when I read a deed, I can't even understand the thing most of the time. How would you understand
it? Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, what the key there is that they have to verify the deed against the meets and bounds description, and there should be the same meets and bounds description both in the deed or contract that the person who is hiring the logging to be done is relying on, and that which is in the contract. And if those two don't match up, that's where the verification process goes in, not on the authenticity of the deed or anything like that, but how it compares to the contract with the logger.
So we're talking about the paper comparison rather than going out and actually being able to read that and know where those corners are.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, so, I mean, what kind of protection, because, I mean, this, you read this, you go, oh, okay, if I go out and do that, then, you know, all you're going to do is find a stupid crook, you know, who, you know, isn't going to make sure that, you know, I'll copy the language from my fake deed and make sure I put that in the contract. But there is no sense there that this is authentic in terms of, and so you're still in such, I'm just curious in terms of how do we provide a protection? Is there something in the marketplace out there in terms of if you go buy a house today, you go buy title insurance, and they verify that there's not liens or anything on the, you know, is there an instrument there that can be developed at the title insurance companies, you know, that can be reasonable, that can give further protection to a contract logger that says, you know, this is real. I can now rely on the fact that, you know, you know, there aren't any liens on the property that if I haul the logs off, somebody's going to still come back to me because, I mean, there seems to be an awful lot of burden placed upon the contract logger here to meet these tests, which ultimately is still going to end in the same thing, whether it's, you know, single, double, or treble, you know, is, I mean, I guess single is better than treble damages. I mean, that's basically what we're arguing here about. Is the logger still going to bear the burden because the guy, the crook who took the money, is probably going to be long gone.
Can I?
Representative Urbel, and then Craig, you need to identify yourself on the tape.
This is in response to Representative Hill. Actually, if you look at the objective of this bill, and the objective is we're not placing a huge burden on the logger. Also, it's very clear here, but we're just saying the steps they have to go through in order that they don't have triple damages assessed against them or double. And it just says they have to verify the deed against what's in the contract. So if a logger makes copies of both and has copies in his records, that's all he's going to have to do is show somebody, see, these are the same, what's in the contract, what's in the deed, and his or her burden is satisfied that.
I guess, Mr. Chair,
it may be wrong, but you know the guy, but the contract loggers are satisfied.
Mm-hmm. I guess where I'm asking the question is, how do we give get the poor contract logger, you know, absent fraud and being involved in the fraud, out of even the single damages? Because I mean, he was defrauded as well, and that's where, you know, it's kind of, and that's where I'm going. Is there, I mean, this may be the first step in this process, and I'm just curious in terms of if there's things that your organization are working on that could come back and satisfy, you know, the legislature and the governor in terms of creating a mechanism that you can provide further protection to the contract logger so that if they're defrauded, they're just like everybody else, and which would then put the burden on, let's go find the person who defrauded.
Chairman Wells, Representative Hill, I think that, you know, that the ultimate, that's the way we see it too. If the operator was not involved in the fraudulent activity, he did everything he was supposed to, then he shouldn't be responsible for even actual damages. He didn't have anything to do with it. Unfortunately, we can't write laws that stop these fraudulent activities, but I think we're putting enough steps in here that a logger could go through to show where he's protected himself, and then we're going to have to go after that fraudulent party. Big time. I think that's where it's at.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, too, Representative Hill's going right down the right line, and I agree 100%. But I think, and Judy probably, Representative Hill, probably better answer, but wouldn't, if the contract logger did these steps to protect himself and then he was still hit with a single damage complaint, he could probably then would have a good action in a civil suit to go after the fraudulent party to receive, though, you know, not only that back, probably plus attorney fees. Of course, we've got to bring attorneys into it. But
in fact, as it requires, in the bill, requires you bring in the other party so that you can do this.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hill.
I guess, to me, the first person they should sue should be the person who did the fraudulent act. And the secondary, because the way this is written here, it's go out and sue the guy who has some hard assets who's sitting there trying to make a living, and the guy who took the money and ran is the secondary, where you go and you try for 6 months to get it from him, and if you can't get the money from him, then you take the money from the guy who's making his living, you know, cutting trees, and you know, and he may have satisfied everything, you know, crossed every T, dotted every I, and he's done what he should have done, but he is still then liable and has been defrauded. And I guess to me, we're still perpetuating that because in Mr. Montgomery's case, the state didn't bother to go after the guy who defrauded because it was just easier to say, hey, he's already paid once, he's got assets, I know where he is, it'd be easier for me to do that than it would be to bring a criminal action against somebody who may be in a different state or down the street and may not have the ability for the money. That's where I'm talking about how we craft a solution for that, which I think has more to do with the AG making a determination, no, we're going to go after the true culprit versus the
Representative Byer and Representative Romano.
I agree with you, Representative Hill, except for one case, and that is the fact that in the case where you've got an innocent landowner, the person who actually owned the trees, they, in your scenario, they would then be the one to be hurt, because if they can't go get the person who actually did the fraud, and at least, and this, I guess, the rationale, I guess I can see as being both a landowner and a contract logger, would be that at least if the landowner is made whole, the logger has the best case and the most incentive to go find the person who did the fraud. Where if we put all the burden onto the landowner, then that's who's going to be left holding the bag.
Well, this issue has been around for years and years. I've grown up out there in the brush, and we know them as jiffle, called jiffle loggers. That's what we called this kind of business, and it's a tough issue to you bring in these loggers. They haul your logs away. They can haul them to four different mills, and then they come back and say, well, this is how many we hauled, or the last guy that hauled any of my logs away, he came back and wouldn't pay me because he says the mills wouldn't pay him. They all went bankrupt, and I had no idea what mill he hauled it to. And I said, no, he's even trying to chase those logs down. I just went on, and then I had another case where I went down on my property, and I knew my neighbor was cutting timber. I walked down there, and here was a bunch of my trees cut down. I went back up to the landowner, and we stood there, and we looked down through there, and we come to an agreement where I haven't even told him about the trees cut down. I don't think he knew this. I says, where's our line? And he says, right there. I says, fine, I was just down there, but 40 feet over on my property are all these trees here. You're longer cut out. So I had him nailed because we'd already agreed where the property line was. That is his house.
You're sneaky.
That is his house. And then I says, fine, I'm down there. You see that tree on that side is a bunch of trees cut out. You know, he says, they are? You know, and so I'm going, yeah, great. You know, so, I mean, this thing goes on and on. I've been through a lot of it, and, Representative Hill, if you can come up with an answer how to solve the trespass problem out here with cutting trees down, this problem's been around, like it says here, since the first axe fell.
It's true.
I say we called them jiffle loggers when I was a kid.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move the bills. There's something else to do.
Craig, have you identified yourself?
No, that's one of the things I need to do. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Associated Oregon Loggers. There is one other comment that I do want to make, and that is that this bill provides a lot more protection for the logger. One of the key things is that right now, the landowner or whoever is the offended party can sue just the logger. Under this bill, they're required to attach the person who purported to be the landowner unless you cannot gain jurisdiction over that person, which is a good protection for the loggers. Is this as far as we would like to go? Probably not, but this provides us with significant levels of protection that we don't currently have. And going back to a comment that Representative Urbelau made, by having the specific requirements in the statute, it's much easier for us to educate the loggers as to what steps they need to take. Right now, we can only recommend what we think they may face in court, and that depends on the court. This provides us a statutory backing that allows us some specificity. Our hope is that this kind of language will prevent a lot of those people who are currently doing the fraudulent activities, because it really limits it to those who are able to do a sophisticated level of fraudulent activity. And so hopefully we'll get rid of a group of those folks who now can get by with this without too much difficulty. It also protects the logger who may not generally pay too much attention to this. Now they will.
I think with that, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 673 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
President Byer.
I move Senate Bill 673A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion to move the bill to the floor. We have any more discussion? Matthew, I'd like to call the roll, please.
Chair.
Yes. Excuse.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Senate Bill 673. Having received the majority of votes, has moved to the floor. Do you have anyone like to carry it? Representative Byer will carry it. Well, that will close the hearing on 673, and if nothing else in front of the committee, we have some bills next Tuesday, so we'll see you next Tuesday. With that, we're adjourned.
Actually.